in Farsi, representing regrowth, health and prosperity.
There are also other things we do to welcome spring, including a major spring cleaning of our homes, shopping for new clothes, and most importantly, visiting one another, short visits that are usually reciprocated.
The Nowruz festive events culminate in Sizdeh Bedar, the 13th day of the new year, which is also the last day of the Nowruz holidays. It is traditionally spent outdoors, picnicking and playing games. The holiday is also referred to as Nature Day.
Happy Nowruz, or as Iranians would say, we wish you 1,000 years better than this year. Gisumi Shahmadi, Tehran.
Afghanistan has been celebrating Nowruz, the Persian New Year, for centuries. It is usually a colorful and joyous festival, welcoming spring and a new life. But the celebration has been dampened since the Taliban's takeover in 2021 and the subsequent economic hardships. Nowruz is no longer an official holiday in Afghanistan. However, the Taliban authorities say they won't prevent people from celebrating the festival.
Our country needs working days rather than a lot of holidays. Nowruz won't be celebrated by the Islamic Emirate, nor is it an official holiday. But we won't stop people from what they do on this day either. However, we will instruct them to act by Islamic law and our values.
Despite challenges, many Afghans are determined to keep their spirits high and enjoy the Nowruz festivities. They dress up in new clothes and visit their relatives and friends. Afghan families also prepare special dishes such as hafsin, samanak, and fish. Many others plant trees and flowers to signify growth and prosperity. All in all, Afghans hope for a better year ahead, one that brings peace and joy to their war-torn country.
Nowruz is our ancestral tradition. It has been passed down to us from generation to generation. Nowruz means a new beginning, and its message is that we should let go of the past and begin a new year with new resolutions.
Nowruz brings us joy and blessing. It's reflecting the rebirth of nature and renewal of sprites. I hope God blesses this year with peace and prosperity. We look forward to witnessing the end of instability and chaos in our country.
Afghan people say they still find joy and meaning in their traditions and culture. For them, Nowruz is more than just a festival. It's a way of life that celebrates your heritage and resilience. Nowruz is a time of joy and the promise of good days to come. Wishing you a happy and prosperous new year. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
On Saturday, sit-ins were held in several countries across the world as part of a campaign aimed at denouncing the devastating effects of the sanctions imposed by the US and the European Union on Syria. The initiative, named End the Siege, has been joined by organizations based in a dozen countries, including Jordan, Palestine, Lebanon, the UK, Germany and Canada. Italy's sit-in was held in Rome in front of the Colosseum, where members of the No War Network and the U.S. Citizens for Peace and Justice denounced how U.S. and EU sanctions have devastated Syria's economy and led to immense human suffering.
Syria is greatly suffering the consequences of the criminal sanctions imposed by our governments, particularly after the earthquake that hit that country over a month ago. Frustration about being excluded from assistance is growing, and I believe it is a scandal that the EU can't act independently, but it has to always submit to the US diktat.
Demonstrators at the sit-in said that the US must leave Syria and stop profiting from Syrian oil and wheat that has exacerbated the poverty in the country. Italy and Syria once maintained a robust relationship, but in 2012, 1 year after the Syrian conflict, Rome joined its Western allies in closing its embassy in Damascus. 7 years later, in 2019, when Italy had an anti-establishment government under the leadership of the Five Star Movement and the Northern League, it appeared that Rome was mulling over normalizing relations with Damascus and reopening its embassy there. However, something went wrong.
It happened that the then government was under enormous pressure, particularly by the United States. Everybody knows that Italy is a country with limited sovereignty. Washington demanded Rome to stop liaising with Damascus the same way it has forced Italy to join the war in Ukraine. One third of Syria is today occupied by American soldiers, and the U.S.'s theft of Syrian oil, natural gas, and other mineral resources have led to energy shortages.
We're here today to do, because this is the 20th anniversary of the invasion and occupation of Iraq by United States troops. They still have a NATO contingent. 1,000 Italian troops are leading the contingent to rob the oil from northeast Iraq, impoverish the Iraqis, and send the oil to Turkey, Israel, and clients of the United States.
The February 6th earthquake has further worsened the already deteriorating economy and humanitarian situation in Syria. According to UN sources, even before the earthquake tragedy, 70% of the population needed humanitarian assistance due to the war in the country and the US-EU sanctions. Max Civili, Rome.
Syrian President Bashar al-Assad received heads of Arab political parties who arrived in Damascus to hold an emergency meeting of the General Conference of Arab Parties. Assad said there is currently an opportunity for political parties to take action in resisting the siege imposed on the countries they represent, underlining the importance of dialogue in expanding the conference to include various political movements and forces. Head of the conference, Qasem Saleh, expressed solidarity with Syrians affected by the earthquakes. Members of the delegation called for ending the occupation of Syrian lands, lifting the U.S. economic siege, and activating joint Arab action.
We can relay to President Assad our stances and listen to his advices for activating joint Arab action and the role of youth. We are betting on the youth at this stage for finding creative solutions for political, economic, and social challenges.
Representatives of parties then held the 63rd emergency meeting of the General Conference of Arab Parties. They underlined the importance of respecting Syria's sovereignty and unity and rejected unilateral economic sanctions on Syria. They asserted that resistance blocked the implementation of a colonialist plot in the region that aimed at eliminating the Palestinian cause and defeating Syria.
We unconditionally stand with Syrian people, army, and leadership, which paid a heavy price to defend just Arab causes. Syria is the source of our history and civilizations. Arab states should return to Syria.
What happens in Syria affects Lebanon and vice versa. We entered into Syria at a particular time in support of its leadership, army, and people. We came to Syria to defend Lebanon. If Syria had collapsed, the whole region would have collapsed. Even Iran's support to Syria was aimed at defending Iran because Syria was the first defense line of all resistance forces in the region.
Participants rejected all forms of normalization with Israel. They welcomed the restoration of diplomatic relations between Iran and Saudi Arabia, underlining it would greatly contribute to solving regional problems. The conference is being held at a time Syrians are extremely suffering from the repercussions of a foreign-backed conflict, unilateral sanctions, and most recently, the devastating earthquake. It's a wake-up call to the international community to take urgent actions and help resolve Syria's dilemmas. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
The combined joint drill of Iran, China, and Russia in the north of Oman Sea ended with a parade of participating vessels in front of the Iranian Jamaran destroyer.
We have successfully wrapped up the final day of the joint exercise. On the last day, we practiced rescuing a ship hijacked by pirates and extinguished the fire of a damaged ship. These important exercises were aimed at improving security in the northern part of the Indian Ocean, as well as countering maritime piracy and terrorism. We have managed to achieve all predetermined goals of the drill, Our main goal is to attract the collective participation of friendly and aligned countries in this region.
On the final day of the 2023 Maritime Security Belt exercise, with the presence of the naval forces of Iran, China, and Russia, the maritime and aerial units of the three countries carried out fire extinguishing operations. They also conducted rescue and relief operations of the injured, as well as towing a damaged ship to a port. In another exercise, special operations teams of Iran, China, and Russia practiced freeing a trade vessel that had been hypothetically hijacked by pirates in international waters. In this part of the exercise, arresting the pirates, countering the acts of sabotage by pirates to delay rescue operation, and also treating the injured were successfully conducted.
Our goal from conducting this exercise was cooperation based on mutual respect. We believe powerful countries like Iran, China, and Russia can play an important role in helping the global economy and security.
The 2023 Maritime Security Belt Joint Exercise is the fourth joint naval exercise of Iran, Russia, and China in recent years. Kazakhstan and Pakistan were also present as observers in this year's exercise. Admiral Irani said the naval units of these countries will participate in 2024 joint exercise. The exercises are the latest in the joint drills by Iran, China, and Russia. Iran says all regional countries are most welcome to take part in the next year drills because they are the ones that are truly in charge of establishing security in the region. Mahdi Abbasian, Konarak.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets and thy messengers whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change. And that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward. And he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive. And make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans. And muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
Sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to another edition of Spotlight. Now, in this edition, Chinese President Xi Jinping has arrived in Moscow on Monday, saying that his first state visit to Russia since the Ukraine conflict would give a new momentum to the bilateral ties of Russia and China. And, of course, that definitely did happen. A new era has begun, and an agreement has been signed between the two presidents containing their no-limit partnership. In this edition of Spotlight, we will discuss what this means for the rest of the world. But first, this report.
During a meeting with Russian Prime Minister Mikhail Mishustin in Moscow, China's President Xi Jinping explained why Russia is his first destination following his re-election.
This is in line with historical logic because we are each other's largest neighboring powers. We are also all-round strategic partners.
This is the 40th meeting between Putin and Xi during their presidency, which indicates the high and close level of cooperation between China and Russia for a long time. President Xi arrived in Moscow on March 24 for a three-day visit. He began his visit with an informal meeting with Vladimir Putin, which lasted almost 5 hours. On Tuesday, the head of state held an official meeting at the Grand Kremlin Palace. The priority in relations between Russia and China is trade and economic cooperation. In the documents signed by the two leaders, they vowed to multiply the volume of trade. It is expected that the Russian Federation and China will exceed the historical record trade volume of $200 billion this year. On February 24th, on the anniversary of the start of the Russian military operation in Ukraine, the Chinese Foreign Ministry presented a 12-point plan to resolve the conflict in Ukraine.
We believe that many of the provisions of the peace plan put forward by China are consonant with Russian approaches and can be taken as the basis for a peaceful settlement when they are ready for it in the West and in Kiev. However, so far we have not observed such readiness on their part.
China and Russia, as permanent members of the UN Security Council, also vowed to uphold the fundamental norms of international relations and build up constructive force for the formation of a multipolar world.
As for sending military equipment and weapons, military cooperation, China is unlikely to take drastic steps. First of all, China acts based on its own interests, not forgetting that relations with the Western world do not become bad. Otherwise, China itself faces sanctions. Its main trading partners are still in the West.
Putin and Xi Jinping also signed two joint documents setting long-term goals until 2030 across all tracks, a statement on plans for economic cooperation and a statement on plans to deepen partnership.
The Chinese president's three-day visit to Russia demonstrates the close historical relations between Beijing and Moscow. Any agreement made during Xi's trip can be regarded as a milestone given the fact that a new world order is being shaped. Marina Kartonova, Moscow.
Now, to discuss this further, we're joined by Glenn Deason, professor of political science from the University of Southeastern Norway. Also, we have with us Gilbert Doctorow, independent international affairs analyst, who is joining us live from Brussels. Now, let's begin with our guest from Oslo. Xi Jinping says that China and Russia should work more closely to push forward greater practical cooperation. When we're talking about practical cooperation, particularly after that no-limits agreement that was signed between the two presidents, so what does he mean?
Well, it has many dimensions. It's towards constructing what both sides would like to be, a multipolar system. So it has a security dimension. It has also political objectives in terms of rejecting what Washington refers to as the rules-based international order, and instead remain with international law, which is what they insist on. But more specifically, it's economics which underpins this, which means that they both countries seek to develop an economic partnership, which focuses on developing common technological platforms and cooperation between different technological hubs. They want to cooperate on the digitalization of their economies. Agriculture is a key component. They both want deepen energy cooperation. So this has primarily, at least in the past, meant a lot of gas, oil, but also within nuclear power. More LNG terminals and cooperation. We also see more cooperation within transportation corridors, not just the bridge crossings along the Amur River connecting Russia and China, but also this wider east-west transportation corridors facilitated primarily by the Belt and Road Initiative. We also have the Arctic corridor, which Russia wants to develop, in which you have maritime traffic between Europe and Asia through the Russian Arctic. And also you have huge development of new institutions, be it BRICS or the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. These institutions are expanding, not just in terms of taking in new members, but they're also expanding their competencies. And of course, the Eurasian Economic Union, led by Russia, also deepening cooperation with China. And this is on top of the overall attempt to grow trade, ideally beyond $200 billion of this year alone. And yeah, to top it off, they're also working more now towards settling their trade more in dollars. So I think 2/3 of their trade is already in rubles and yuans. But they would like to increase this not just among each other, but also with the rest of the world. So, as Russia's made it clear, they're quite happy to accept the Chinese currency, the yuan, and also in their own trade with the rest of the world. So it has a huge, huge dimension, which is why the Chinese arrived. Well, they came for 3 days with such a large delegation, as these two Eurasian giants would like to construct a new international economic architecture as an alternative to integrating under the United States' administrative control over its format of the international economy.
Exactly, a new architecture, but that definitely will expand more than just trade and business. It will definitely have ramifications in the political sphere as well. But before we get to that, let's bring in Gilbert Doctorow. Well, Putin has also clearly said that economy and economic cooperation between Beijing and Moscow is his priority. And of course, our guest from Oslo also pointed out the different aspects of what this could spell for the rest of the world. And most importantly, what we see, Mr. Doctor, I believe, is that the U.S. and Western sanctions now mean absolutely nothing.
Well, looking at this, the results of this meeting, I have to say we know very, very little. The joint declaration, which is quite extensive, has almost nothing concrete in it. It makes reference to a 2001 treaty between China and Russia on good neighborly relations and cooperation. And like that treaty, it goes through a shopping list of many different domains where the two countries intend to develop their relations. The language of this joint declaration is what I would call, as a Kremlinologist, wooden language. It is very opaque. We have no real understanding of what took place, either in the 8 hours of meetings in 2 days, eye to eye between Putin and Xi, and the meetings of the at the minister level, a limited number of attendees, which took place each day with a different composition of those working groups each day. We don't know. This is like wartime secrecy. And it's understandable because of the hostile environment globally in which this meeting took place. But for us as analysts, it makes our job very difficult. I would like to call attention to a couple of features that we were able to tweak out from the official documents using the methods of traditional Kremlinology. In this particular case, you try to understand what took place at the working groups by looking at who took part, who was there and who was not there. There is a military affairs analyst, a certain Andrei Marchanov, who produced a rather spectacular analysis of day one of these meetings, and looking at the attendance there, not of Russia's military procurement officer, which is what the West would have us believe these meetings were about, to provide Russia with missing munitions or whatever, but with Russia's military sales director, and points us into a fact which is very important as we consider the Russian-Chinese relationship, that it is not a junior position that Russia has, but it's a fully equal position, because Russia has military hardware that China wants and needs in its own standoff with the United States. And by that, I mean the hypersonic missiles. On the negative side, tweaking the results of day two, which was in which the trade and transportation ministers were present, we have to say that the one result that was disappointing was the Chinese failure to endorse the Power of Siberia 2 pipeline going from the gas production centers in Western Siberia, which otherwise had been supplying gas to Europe, and crossing Mongolia to reach the western edges of China. That was supposed to be signed off, or many analysts expected it would be, but it wasn't. That by itself indicates that China is not too alarmed at possible sanctions or pressure being applied by the United States to it.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
let's bring back our guest from Oslo, Mr. Glenn Deason. Moscow has said that it is ready to expand its cooperation in different fields. It has mentioned gas and oil and also internet, which, of course, both sides believe now there is some kind of Western hegemony regarding internet and social media that's being used. Do you think that, unlike what happened with the Siberia 2 pipeline, we will see some more practical measures taking place regarding internet and social media?
Well, I'm not sure about the social media, but at least, that would imply a lot of harmonization of legislation. I'm not sure about this, but within the technological partnerships, this has been the common trend. That is, obviously, China has more advanced technology and economy, but Russia has prioritized having autonomy. That means to have its own digital ecosystem within Russia, in which the dominant companies are all local and Russian. However, having complete autonomy or self-sufficiency is not good for efficiency or to have a developed, a strong economy. So obviously Russia seeks us to have as many partners as possible. And due to the economic conflict with the West, it obviously makes sense for Russia to replace a lot of those partners in the West with China, because, well, you can't get around the fact that China is the technological leader now. But I would say that this efforts of decoupling from the West, I think this has been it's been going on for quite some time, because it's whoever controls the leading technologies, whoever controls the dominant industries, the key transportation corridors, the main banks, the reserve currency, the transaction system, the payment systems. This is what creates dependencies. And whenever you have excessive dependency or asymmetrical interdependency, in which one actor is excessively dependent on the other, you can convert this into political influence. So this is something that both Russia and China has been quite concerned about. So it is, they do see this partnership to some extent as being anti-hegemonic. So this is why both sides are seeking, again, to create new poles of power, new centers. So that means, hence, more cooperation in the area of industrial cooperation, technologies, new transportation corridors, new development banks, trade in local currencies, develop new payment systems, and effectively deprive Washington and the collective West of some of this economic dominance, which they're now increasingly using for political influence in a coercive way, I would say, not just against Russia, but against China as well. So this is quite natural. This is a balancing. Both Russia and China has been obviously expressing the desire to be able to balance or decouple to some extent, or at least diversify away from excessive reliance on Western economies due to our economic statecraft. But now they have the capacity to do so, and especially now at the height of conflict that we are fighting a proxy war against Russia. Well, we're fighting with Ukrainians, but also now increasing the pressure and threats against China. It only makes sense that they would seek to reduce their vulnerability and their exposure towards our economic statecraft.
But still, Mr. Deason, it seems that China is trying to be more cautious than that. And as Mr. Doctor also explained, in order to wrap up this part regarding the economy, move on to the political aspects of these strengthened ties, Mr. Doctor, Moscow has also said that it is ready to increase oil exports to Beijing. Do you see any breakthroughs regarding this proposal anytime soon?
No, I don't see numbers put down. There's the ambition to raise trade to 200 billion, but I would point out that trade is already in 2022 at 185 billion. So it's curious that the bar that's set for this current year is, I would say, low. The increase in trade between the two parties last year was 33%. And the target for this year seems to be 8% increase. That's not much. So what's holding it back is precisely the lack of an adequate infrastructure to deliver oil and gas in great quantities to China. And that is why the failure to sign off an agreement on the power of Siberia too at this meeting is rather surprising. The purpose of that very pipeline was to make available to the Chinese market the sources of production of gas in Yamal, in the North Siberia and Central West Siberia, which had been dedicated to supplying gas pipeline, supplying gas via pipeline to Western Europe. The Siberia 1, Power of Siberia 1 pipeline is drawing on what was at the time of its laying down a new source of gas in Eastern Siberia or Western Maritime Province. So the a very important possible source of increased sales and trade turnover has been put on hold. As for oil, it would be very interesting to see what kind of logistical solutions the Russians and the Chinese arrive at. Most of that oil will have to be carried by tankers. Russia is in a difficult position because of the restrictions established by the United States and picked up by other G7 members, and which means the European Union, whereby buyers or shippers who do not adhere to the limitation or the limit that is the top price set on for Russian oil and oil derivative exports, in case they are above those levels, insurance is not issued, and practically speaking, it's difficult to ship. This has left Russia with a need to hastily put together a gray and fully owned tanker fleet, and it'd be interesting to see what might have been discussed between the parties behind closed doors to facilitate the increase in Russian shipping abilities for oil. Failing that, you can't increase the oil deliveries to China.
Okay, so let's wrap up the entire economic aspect of this meeting and move on to the political aspects of it. Well, of course, the Chinese president came to Moscow with a proposal to end the Ukraine conflict. So, Mr. Deason, Russia welcomed that proposal, but do you think the West and Kiev are actually ready?
Well, Russia gave a tentative or a cautious approval. They didn't agree fully. I mean, the agreement has some aspects, such as respecting territorial sovereignty, and Russia's not going to it's not going to leave these territories it has acquired, because they recognize this to be a part of Russian sovereign territory. That means Lugansk, Donetsk, Kherson, and Zaporozhye. So there's some limitations, but obviously, I think the United States has very clearly stated their objections. The diplomatic thing for the Americans to do would say, well, give us the proposal, we'll look through it, and we'll take it as a starting point. But they didn't do it. From the get-go, they said any suggestion to have a ceasefire is, according to John Kirby, was unacceptable. So they're not prepared for any ceasefire or start of any peace negotiations. But it is interesting because China's now pushing, it's on a peace tour, if you will. They've now recently established this agreement between Saudi Arabia and Iran to restore diplomatic relations, which is quite important. They want to now have an agreement between Iran and GCC. And the reason I bring this up is it's quite important because once you pick a hole in an alliance, and this is the anti-Iranian alliance, you see it slowly collapsing. For example, the head of Mossad came out and then said after this, perhaps we need also new policy towards Iran. We need to resolve our differences. So you don't want to be the last country left in an alliance against a country. And I think the same applies with Ukraine. As long as China comes out, it puts a peace proposal, and there's no other proposals on the table. I think once some of the countries begin to look at this, it's possible that the coalition against Russia will start to break up, and some countries will try to come to the table. I mean, for Kiev, they're in quite a difficult position, because as we know, in March. This is when, after the Russians had invaded, within the first couple of days, you know, the Russians they put out a proposal to Ukraine, saying, listen, if you accept these terms, you know, in very broad terms, implement the Minsk agreement, which they should have done in the previous 7 years, then you know, we will withdraw to where we invaded. And what we found out was the Americans and British, they intervened and told the Ukraine not to accept this. Now, the reason for this was, they said, we'll give you all the weapons you want, and you continue to fight, and then you don't have to make a compromise with the Russians. Well, as it turns out now, both the Ukrainians and the Americans have become quite exhausted. But the problem is, Ukraine now is completely dependent on the United States. So I think if China has something to offer the Ukrainians, something, you know, like another leg to stand on, a crutch, if you will, then it is possible that they could try to not win them over, but to at least give them an alternative to merely, you know, banging their heads against the wall, because this war is to a large extent already lost. They can't win this anymore. So, again, maybe I'm being too optimistic, but I think from the way I see it, the Chinese have put forward this agreement. The Americans will obviously reject it. The Russians are cautiously approving of it. The Ukrainians, again, this is the wild card. While the Europeans, so far, we're following the Americans on this. But,
Thank you very much, Mr. Deason. We're running out of time, and I need to ask this last question from Mr. Doctorow. We have less than a minute left, and I know you're going to need a lot more time to give us an answer to this one. But taking all of these different things that we talked about into consideration, do you believe that we're witnessing the creation of a multilateral management system or a new world order?
Well, yes, we definitely are. But it's not going to take place tomorrow. It has to begin somewhere. It has begun on February 24th, 2022, with the launch of a special military operation, which polarized the world, which created an enormous challenge to the American-led West. I slightly regret that the peace proposal of the Chinese was not put forward. It was listed in the joint declaration in Section 8 out of 9 sections. I think the Russians and the Chinese have lost an opportunity to wage a peace offensive against the United States.
Thank you very much, Mr. Gilbert Doctorow, independent international affairs analyst from Brussels, and Mr. Glenn Deason, professor of political science from the University of Southeastern Norway from Oslo. Thank you very much to both of you gentlemen for sharing your thoughts and views with us on this edition of Spotlight.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذی
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد موسیقی خاصی دارد روش خاصی دارد اینها چیزایی لازم نیست.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن. از قرآن.
Muslims major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran. Quran.
کتاب الله.
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime of Israel has expanded its illegal settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories, while the international community considers these settlements to be illegal and has repeatedly demanded that all construction should stop. We take a look at some of the world media and press's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The English website of Al Jazeera Television Network has covered this story and tells us more. The Israeli regime's far-right cabinet has decided to legalize 9 settler outposts in the occupied West Bank in sheer defiance of the outcry from the international community and Palestinians who want an end to the Israeli regime's illegal settlement activities. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's extremist cabinet announced the decision on Sunday, 12th of February, retroactively authorizing the outposts that had been already set up by Israeli settlers over the past years without the regime's so-called approval. The retroactive authorization of the outposts marks the first such step to be taken by Israel's new cabinet, which took over in late December, featuring a combination of hard-right and ultra-orthodox parties. The Israeli Prime Minister has described expansion of the regime's illegal settlements as his cabinet's top priority in order to buy the extremist party's loyalty. However, the international community views the settlements, hundreds of which have been built across the occupied West Bank since Tel Aviv's occupation of the territory in 1967, as illegal due to their construction in the occupied territories. Also on Sunday, 12th of February, a statement from Benjamin Netanyahu's office said a planning committee was to convene in the coming days to approve new settler units and mass construction of more units within the existing settlements. The far-right Israeli finance minister, Bezalel Smotrich, put the number of units at a whopping 10,000. Reacting to the Israeli cabinet's decision, Nabil Abu Rodena, the spokesman for the Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas, condemned the move as a provocation and a recipe for further tension and escalation. Nabil Abu Rodena also announced the regime's plans to staggeringly increase the number of settler units, adding that all unilateral measures are rejected in accordance with the resolutions of international legitimacy and bilateral agreements. Abu Rodena also stressed the illegality of all Israeli settlements as they violate international law and UN Security Council resolutions, including Resolution 2334. The Palestinian Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Expatriates also weighed in on the issue, issuing a statement saying that The Israeli cabinet's decision amounted to a dangerous escalation. The statement added the move was also a total and open war against the Palestinian people, the occupied city of Al-Quds and the residents of the city and other holy sites. The Reuters news agency has also covered this story and tells us more. An extremist Israeli regime minister from Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's far-right cabinet wants to see more Jewish settlements constructed across the occupied Palestinian territories. Israel's hardline security minister Itamar Ben-Gvir said on Tuesday, 14th of February, "Building new settlements is Israel's mission and doctrine." Following a statement of concern from Washington and from European countries, France, Germany, Italy and Britain, over the decision on legalizing 9 settler outposts, he claimed in a video message, "The land of Israel belongs to the people of Israel." On Sunday, 12th of February, the Israeli regime's far-right cabinet legalized 9 settler outposts in the occupied West Bank in sheer defiance of the outcry from the international community and from Palestinians who want an end to the Israeli regime's illegal settlement activities. Itamar Ben-Gvir said he wanted to go even further than the decision announced on Sunday, saying 9 settlements are not enough and Israel wants much more. He said, "This is our mission, this is our doctrine. 9 settlements is nice, but it's still not enough. We want much more." The extremist Israeli minister said Europeans and Americans should stop worrying. Meanwhile, the foreign ministers of Britain, France, Germany, Italy and United States have all said they're deeply troubled by Israel's illegal settlement activities and expansion plans. They said in a statement, "We strongly oppose unilateral actions which will only serve to exacerbate tensions between Israelis and Palestinians and undermine efforts to achieve a negotiated two-state solution." Hussein al-Sheikh, a senior Palestinian official, welcomed the joint statement. Al-Sheikh said, "We demand that words be turned into deeds. The Israeli regime has already authorized new settlement outposts and pledged to construct new settler units in the occupied West Bank." Meanwhile, the Israeli regime has demolished another Palestinian home in a neighborhood of eastern Al-Quds as its forces detain over a dozen Palestinians in several areas across the occupied West Bank. According to media reports, Israeli bulldozers, accompanied by troops, raided the neighborhood of Jabal al-Mukhabar at dawn on Monday, 13th of February, and cordoned off the house before demolishing it. They claimed the house belonging to Avam Bashir had been constructed without a permit. The so-called permits are almost impossible to obtain. Israel sometimes orders Palestinian owners to demolish their own houses or pay the cost of the demolition. The Tel Aviv regime plans to force out Palestinian families from the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood and several other neighborhoods of eastern Al-Quds in an attempt to replace them with illegal Israeli settlers. The Palestinian Wafa news agency has also covered this story and tells us more. A panel of United Nations experts has called on the international community to take action to stop systematic housing demolition, arbitrary displacement and forced evictions of Palestinians from the occupied West Bank. The Palestinian Wafa news agency cited experts as making the plea in a statement on Monday, 13th of February, after media reports that the Israeli regime demolished 132 Palestinian structures across 38 communities in the occupied West Bank in January of 2023, a 135% increase compared to the same period in 2022. The statement said the systematic demolition of Palestinian homes erection of illegal Israeli settlements and systematic denial of building permits for Palestinians in the occupied West Bank amounts to domicide. The experts reiterated their concern over the situation in Masafer Yatar area, where over 1,100 Palestinian residents remain at imminent risk of forced eviction, arbitrary displacement and demolitions of their homes, their livelihood, water and sanitation structures. The experts say direct attacks on the Palestinian people's homes, schools, livelihoods and water resources are nothing but Israel's attempts to curtail the Palestinian people's right of self-determination and to threaten their very existence. Experts say Israel's tactics of forcibly displacing and evicting the Palestinian population appear to have no limits. In occupied city of Eastern Al-Quds, tens of Palestinian families also face imminent risk of forced eviction and displacement due to discriminatory zoning and planning regimes that favor Israeli settlement expansion. The act that is illegal under international law and amounts to a war crime.
Voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.